Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 289 of the Fun with Cars, Formula One, and Other Motorsports podcast, or episode 23 of 2021. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man who is confused why Lewis Hamilton yet again couldn't win this weekend, Christopher Roche. Hi, Chris.
But an ex-Formula One driver did.
That's right. That is exactly right. It was a very Formula One heavy weekend, just not with current Formula One drivers. It is Monday afternoon, June 14th, and Chris and I are going to talk about three races held this past weekend in Detroit. Yes, and I was there. I have six interviews with seven different drivers, including Formula One veteran Romain Grosjean. That's right. And I need to get better at pronouncing his name correctly. It's like Romain Grosjean, and that's not right either. Anyway, I have that. I have six-time IndyCar champion Scott Dixon, as well as newer IndyCar driver Jack Harvey. And then I also spoke with Dane Cameron, Olivier Pla, Brian Sellers, and Jack Hawksworth on the IMSA side of things. Lots of great conversations. Chris, where should we begin?
I think Detroit Grand Prix race one.
Well, that's a lovely place to start.
Yeah, pole position, Palou, who's continuing his strong, it wasn't Palou, was it? It was Award who got pole position.
Pato Award.
Yeah.
Pato Award's McLaren, the one that got the pole position. Yeah.
McLaren continuing their strong form. Palou got a sixth place grid penalty. I was reading the wrong part of my notes. So he had a penalty for an early engine change. So good to know that engine change penalties have crossed the pond.
Yeah. Well, you know, racing is more and more becoming a global beast. So, hey, why not include penalties as well? But, yeah, it was Pato Award on pole, but that didn't last too terribly long, did it?
No, it did not. He got swamped, didn't he?
Yeah, well, it was an interesting case. So, one thing, Detroit is an extremely fascinating race to watch for several reasons. And that's the way the track is laid out, the speed of that track with that layout, but also the huge variability you can have in the weather. I've been at the Detroit Grand Prix when it was pouring rain and barely 50 degrees outside. I've been at the Detroit Grand Prix when it's sunny, humid, and 90 degrees outside. And obviously, between those two differences alone, the engine has a hugely different task in front of itself. And of course, there's big variabilities in tire wear, etc., etc. Well, we were definitely on the high side of the temperature and heat load this weekend, and that meant that the optional tires that IndyCar uses, which are red striped on the sidewalls, were no good for more than a few laps. And so a lot of people were having to figure out the best strategy for how to use the red tires, because you have to use them during the race for at least one lap. And Pato Award was one of the first people to come in. I think he only did two full laps in the race on those optional red tires.
Yeah, well, they proved to be quite a talking point throughout the weekend, didn't they? And probably cost Newgarden his win in race two. But focusing on race one, I guess, you know, there were quite a few different tire strategies going on, but I think also throttle application strategies varied. And it turns out that keeping it full open, the throttle that is, through turn six doesn't work that well.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So we had a pretty exciting race going on early on, but then around lap 25, it was Felix Rosenqvist had a wide open throttle. I don't know if it was stuck open or if something happened that he was applying it. I haven't learned anything beyond that, but he went wide open throttle into the wall, had enough energy to push the wall, push the barriers over. I just massacred, climbed the fence more than halfway up, and that turned into an over an hour long red flag of race one.
Yeah, it was a massive shunt. I mean, unfortunately, he hit the barrier toward the exit of the corner, didn't he? He sort of made most of the turn. It wasn't like he went straight on where the barrier was deepest. And so there were less tires, and those temporary concrete blocks they install to act as a reaction force for the tires to compress against. And he managed to push one of those concrete blocks quite a few feet in board of where it had been mounted, and it was
and he pushed it over as well.
Yeah. And then of course he ended up at about a 40-45 degree angle, didn't he? Which meant extricating him from the car was tricky. Massive shunt, very scary. What I've read is that he definitely, it wasn't a driver error. It was a mechanical issue, and they're saying that it was a stuck throttle. But maybe there'll be more analysis in due course. But scary moment for him. And of course he then was admitted to a local Detroit hospital and didn't take part in race two. So we wish him a swift recovery and a return to the field.
We don't know too much right now, but it sounded like a lot of what the hospital stay was for was precautionary. Mm-hmm. And he never lost consciousness, and I don't think there's anything that's life-threatening in the least. He's okay. Is he 100% race healthy? That we're not sure of yet, but
right,
he is alive, and he has no imminent threat there otherwise. But yeah, it was a properly scary moment. I haven't seen an accident like that in a long time, and he was probably close to 100 miles an hour when he hit that concrete barrier. It was a big hit.
Yeah, scary. Good onboard footage. It was a scary moment, no doubt, because you could just hear the throttle just doesn't adjust as he goes through the turn. And you know, if you lifted your foot and yet you're still full open throttle, that would be a horrible moment.
Yes, absolutely. They did get him out, and they fixed the wall, and the race did eventually resume.
And Will Power dominated.
Will Power was looking very, very good. He was in the lead, healthy for a long, long time, but not towards the very end, because we had another former Formula One driver, one Romain Grosjean, have an issue and hit the wall with, I don't know if that was 12 laps to go, 10 laps to go, something like that, which brought out another, I think it was a red flag, just because it was towards the end of the race.
Yeah, it looks like, wasn't it in the fountain section? It looks like he launched over the curb on the inside, and that threw him into the wall. Clumsy accident, fortunately, for Mr. Big John.
Sorry, please go ahead.
I was going to say, yeah, they did throw a red flag, and they got all the cars to come into pit lane, and that's when the drama really started to unfold.
So the Detroit curbs, just real quick, are not carbon copies, but similar to the old Nordschleife and Nürburgring curbs. They're painted, but they're like, 45 degree sharp angle up. So if you get on those curbs much at all, that will quickly unsettle a Formula car and just completely change your trajectory. And that's basically what happened. And there were no tires, but obviously this was a much softer hit relatively. The fountain area of the Detroit Grand Prix is one of the slower sections of the track, so the speeds weren't too terribly high.
That's right. Yeah, it was just one of those sort of clumsy shunts that blocks the track, right, and necessitates a caution to clear it up. And of course, as you mentioned, it was very hot in Detroit. So I was, interesting rule in IndyCar. So when the cars come into pit lane and they shut them off, obviously the cars don't get any cooling air. And apparently the rule is that you can't put any supplemental fans or cooling systems on a stationary vehicle until all of the cars have entered the pit lane. So that meant that poor Will Power, who shut down first because he was leading the race at the time, his team, his crew couldn't do anything until the last runner came into the pit lane, by which point I guess his ECU had fried, just completely overheated with no cooling air. And so they couldn't restart his car, unfortunately, and therefore he lost out on the win, and he was furious, and his crew was furious too. I mean, this is coming off the back of a pretty tough Indy 500 weekend, and that, to be leading seemingly with the race, in complete, control, and almost the, tasting the champagne, next thing you know, it's denied you. So that was a tough one for Will to take.
Will was in a pretty dour mood to start for that weekend. And and there's kind of like this reputations of Australians being easygoing, no worries kind of folk.
Yeah.
Yeah, Willpower is not that. He's definitely can get uneasy about things. And he was very lovingly calling some of his IndyCar competitors wankers because they were blocking him and being in his way and at different times. So, yeah, to have his engine not start after a red flag when he's already that way, I can only imagine that he needed a little cooling off time, to be blunt about it, himself. So, you know, the auxiliary fans might have been pointed at the wrong ECU at the Willpower's team. But, you know, he's 40, but still crazy quick. And he was driving very well, leading this race, had a very good chance to win this race. And it was nothing other than bad luck that took him out. But what it did mean is that IndyCar got its seventh different winner in seven races. And this time around, it was former Formula One driver, and I'm surprised to even say this, Marcus Ericsson. Ericsson held on the last few laps and won his first IndyCar race. In fact, won his first race since racing GP2. So,
won. Back in 2013, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny, a bit like Chilton. I mean, he hasn't really set the IndyCar world alight, has he, since he joined in 2019? You know, he got some top 10 finishes last year with a fourth place at Road America, but he hasn't really featured that strongly so far in 2021. So, yeah, I mean, fair play. He was fairly close to power before the red flag came out. You know, he was challenging for the win, so it wasn't like he completely lucked into it. Obviously, he benefited from power's mechanical issues, but no, fair play. Amazing to see him bounce back and be a winner again.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I think that he did a good job, and he handled the different pressures of the race well, and deserves full credit for being able to claim that win. Now, we mentioned Romain Grosjean. He crashed out, a little bit clumsy, as you said. But I want to point out that Romain qualified third in the race. So he was showing real speed in that Dale Coyne race car. And before he did that, he sat down in a Honda motorhome with me, and we chatted for a few minutes. And I put that conversation up on YouTube. So there's links to the Fun with Cars Facebook page if you haven't seen it yet. And I'll definitely include links to it on the show notes. But I'm also going to play it for you right now. So here is my conversation with Romain Grosjean, or Big John, or Rogro, or whatever. Okay, I'm sitting next to the great and very much still alive with two functioning hands, Romain Grosjean, and I'm extremely excited to talk to him as an avid Formula One fan and IndyCar fan. But I think we have to start with the most important question first. How do you pronounce your name?
This is a good question. It's a tough one. Romain Grosjean would be the perfect pronunciation, but I don't think it's feasible in English. So Romain Grosjean, RG, Rogro, whatever you want, the Phoenix, that works.
Well, I've said that now that you're doing American racing, you're now Romain Grosjean. Is that close enough, or how should we adjust it?
I don't know. I think Grosjean could mean Big John. John, you know, if that makes it easier. I know my name is hard to pronounce in other language than French. So Romain Grosjean, that works well for me.
But that's actually another question I have. You're technically Swiss. Right or wrong? How does that connection work?
I've got two passports. So I was born in Switzerland from a Swiss dad and a French mom. So I was raised in Switzerland. So I basically grew up as a man in Switzerland. But I always raced in France on a French license. So I feel like a French athlete, but probably a Swiss man.
Very good, very good. So
You came up in a racing. You were obviously just in the heart of Europe, racing in Formula cars. You got to Formula One twice, raced several years in Formula One with a lot of success, even though you were not with top teams necessarily. Now that you're in the United States, how do you look back at the Formula One days?
It's been a great experience. You know, it's been an incredible part of my life. If I think of when I was a youngster, you know, and I wanted to go racing karts and so on, and I wanted to make it to Formula One. If you had told me one day I would do 180 Formula One Grand Prix, I would just, and 10 times on the podium, I would say you're crazy. So, you know, I think it was incredible, that part of my life. But that chapter is kind of closed, and I needed something new.
So now you're racing in IndyCar. It's still open wheel and still a top tier series, but I suppose you could say a little bit more regional. What has been the biggest adjustment for you to make from European based open wheel racing to American based open wheel racing?
Well, I think it's the driving, you know, the driving style that is different. Learning the track, learning the car, driving very differently. The Firestone tires are really good, so you know you can actually push and lean on them, and that's something that I wasn't quite doing in Formula One. So it's been really adapting to the races, the racetrack, the car. The atmosphere in the paddock is amazing. I love, you know, the fans are great. The circuits are mega. You know, I've had really good support from the team, from Honda, from Firestone, on getting knowledge and up to speed quickly. So that's been great. We said the challenge was just getting adapted to the car.
Well, you certainly have gotten up to speed. You had that fantastic pole position at the Indianapolis Grand Prix, the road course ahead of the 500, and ended up finishing second on the podium. Really good feeling. You have a chance to perform really, really well at a complicated street circuit here in Detroit, which is actually deceptively quick, despite the fact that it's as tight as it is. So I think that you've certainly proven your abilities behind the wheels of a racing car. And the thing I'm curious about is the Indy car is much simpler than a Formula One car. If you look at the steering wheel of an Indy car, the number of adjustments, it's, you know, nothing compared, and the car itself is a lot more raw, like closer to roots of racing than in Formula One, where there's so much more technology. Has that been an adjustment, or has that just been a relief, a refreshing to have something just a little bit more pure pace on the driver?
I would say that the whole experience in IndyCar has been a ball of fresh air, you know, from the atmosphere in the paddock to, yes, cars that are much simpler. No need of, you know, managing all the hybrid, the battery and the buttons and so on, and you know, just driving the car. You can adjust your bars so you can make it the way you like, but the cars, yeah, are much simpler, much less technology, but also you can play around with a lot with the car and make it to your liking. So that's been great, because, you know, I can make it the way I like to drive, and we found a really good setup in Indy GP. Hopefully in Detroit we find a good one as well, and we see from there.
So you made the commitment, and this was in part due to surviving that horrific crash in Bahrain, to do road courses only here at Indy. But now you've officially survived being in IndyCar and not competing in the Indianapolis 500, and you've seen just what a big ceremony and race event that is. Does that make you itchy to experience ovals as well? Because skipping Texas, that's one thing, but now that you've seen the Indianapolis 500, does that change your perspective at all?
I think what could change my perspective is that I want to win the championship, and to win the championship you need to compete in every race. So I think that could be the deciding factor. You know, I'm going to do Gateway this summer, which is a short oval, to see how I feel about it. But obviously if there are opportunities in the future to go for the championship, then I'll probably do all the races. But we're not there yet, so, you know, work in progress.
Absolutely. Now, you've been with Haas and Renault in Formula One. Now you're with Honda here in the United States and Dale Coyne Racing. How has that experience been with Honda and with Dale Coyne?
It's been great. It's been, you know, Dale Coyne has a really good nose to feel who which driver could do well in the IndyCar in the USA coming from Europe. He's brought some really good talent over. My engineer has been really helpful. He's a Frenchman, so we've got a good relationship, and that Honda has been super helpful as well with all the simulator work they can do in Indianapolis and learning the track, learning the car, setting it up, giving me also the good power that I need to go fast down the straight. So everyone has been really supportive of the move. It was a big move, and it's a very different series. But as I say, I really enjoy myself, and I want to do more.
Well, that's really wonderful to hear. You've been absolutely fantastic watch so far this season. On a personal level, I really just enjoyed your attitude going into the series, and your openness and all of that. I think it's exactly what the sport has needed, and I just wish you great luck here in Detroit, and again for the rest of the IndyCar series. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup. And that's... Oh, no, let's try this. Okay, I'm going to get back on camera. Romain Grosjean.
Yeah, oui, bien, très bien.
Ah, merci beaucoup.
Yeah, so Jenson Button used to call him Big John. I think, for me, that's a pretty easy thing to pronounce, so I'm going to stick with Big John.
Yeah, and we've got official approval from the man himself. Romain said that Big John is just fine with him. So it seems to be that he prefers Big John to my Gross Gene. So we'll go ahead and transfer that one over. I have to say that he was open, honest, gracious. I mean, he was seriously just an absolute pleasure to talk with. And not at all like the persona that he had built up in his years in Formula One. And it was really just a great conversation, and I really appreciated that he was happy to take the time to chat with me. So thank you again, Romain, for that. And good job in qualifying. A little bit unfortunate in the race.
I wanted to highlight before we leave race one, and it pertains to the whole weekend for IndyCar in Detroit, is that circuit has never been that conducive to great racing in the past, but it was very good this weekend. There were some great old battles, and the scrap between Sato, VK, and Award to get eventual second place was a cracker, and one that I wanted to highlight. And I guess we should also point out that Ericsson actually started from 15th on the grid and won the race. So it's just showing that between the tyres, the strategies, and the ability to actually make on-track passes, it was a real possibility of people, being able to drive well, race well, and improve their position. So VK ended up getting second.
Right.
Yeah, VK got second.
Award
came third. Yeah, that's right. Award got the final podium place, beating out the Rahal Lederman-Lanigan trio of Sato, Rahal, and Ferrucci. And it was an interesting weekend for some of the bigger names. I mean, Dixon seemed to struggle, finishing eventually in eighth. And poor old Newgarden lost a wheel during a pit stop, but managed to recover and get 10th place. There were some really fun battles that I enjoyed watching in race one, and that continued and was even more amplified in race two.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Scott Dixon. He is a consummate professional and always has interesting things to say, and I know that because I've had several chances to get the chance to speak with him, and that included also at this weekend. I spent a few minutes inside the Chip Ganassi trailer transporter and spoke with Scott Dixon as well. And let's go ahead and listen to that now.
I'm standing next to none other, six-time IndyCar champion, 2008 Indy 500 winner, and currently second in the championship this year, the great Scott Dixon. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, yeah. Thanks for having me.
So you've been having a pretty darn good season so far, 2021. Second in the championship right now. You did win a race in Texas. From your point of view, how does it feel?
It's been average, I think. We've had some decent, finishes. I think, Indy was definitely a bummer, and I think Indy's always difficult when it's especially a double points race. a weird circumstance that kind of, you know, took us out of the race from the get-go, falling a lap down in the current formula where the field is so compact it's almost impossible to get that lap back. So kudos to the team for doing that, but then we kind of went an alternate strategy which killed us at the end as well. So it's, I don't know, it's been an interesting start for a lot of people, kind of why I think the points are still fairly tight, sitting in a decent spot considering, I think, the ups and downs that we've had. But yeah, a lot of hard work to come now.
Well, I definitely want to talk about Indy a touch more, but I thought it was really interesting. You've had a win in Texas, and that Texas race was really, really bizarre because that was another doubleheader, and you won the first race. It was a Kiwi special that day, but I was really perplexed by the two different surfaces. So you had the lower, grippier asphalt, and then this, like, new, like, sticky tarmac, good for NASCAR thing. What was that like? Because that seemed dangerous to me.
Yeah, not too many people ventured up there. You know, I think on starts and restarts, you could kind of move up there just with the lower speeds. Yeah, it's kind of still, I think, an area that we need to really look into. You know, it's that that application they put down for the Cup side. You know, we never really get to use it until it's like 3 or 4 months old. So, you know, maybe in the future we need to look at maybe applying something similar or something, you know, the same product, but closer to our event so that we could possibly use it, which none of us have actually ever gone into trying that. So it's, you know, Texas is tough. I think the new circuit, the same for Cup, has made it more difficult to be, you know, side by side, especially through 1 and 2. 3 and 4 is still an option. And you still saw some, you know, some pretty good passing, especially in race 2 at the end there with, you know, Pato taking the win. So could it be better? Absolutely. And it's something that they you know, as IndyCar, I think, should be looking into.
But you didn't consider it inherently unsafe necessarily?
No, it's not unsafe. You know, it's just you don't want to be caught in that compromise of, you know, I think especially when you're running up front, you know, I think it's something that you can manage a little bit different. But, you know, the way that, you know, that some of the cars maybe were kind of out of, you know, TK was a good example of that, you know, a very fast car. And someone that, you know, probably would have been fighting for the win, but because of where he started, made it very difficult. So, you know, those situations are hard, whereas the old Texas kind of, you know, circuit would have been able to pass and get up front if you had a fast car.
So, yeah, we can't avoid talking about Indy. You had the ideal start, starting on pole position. The Honda motor seemed plenty strong in both qualifying and race conditions. And indeed, you were out front in a comfortable position. You let Colton take off and push away some air for you. And then there was that just really unfortunately timed yellow, and then the engine wouldn't start. I mean, from your point of view, walk us through that.
Yeah, honestly, just bad timing. You know, for us, we knew that, you know, VK and probably Herta wanted to lead the race, which was fine with us. We wanted to start stretching the fuel windows as quick as possible, and I think we went almost 5 laps longer than VK, you know, just because he led all those early laps, which is, you know, part of what our plan was. The car was very strong, very good, you know, but going that long put us in a very compromised situation with that caution coming out. Seemed like a lot of people during the race had a brake issue, you know, which caught Stefan out as well. So once the pits are closed and once it's blocked like that, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do. And I think it took them a lot longer to clean up than we had probably imagined. Otherwise, we would have pit on the front end of that just to be safe and go to the back of the line. But unfortunately, we tried to stretch it so we didn't lose any positions, and that ultimately ran the engine out of fuel. And with the high-pressure systems on these, it takes a long time to prime them. So, you know, we lost that lap just trying to prime the engine. So definitely a frustrating situation. I think with all the hard work and effort that goes into that event, you know, winning the pole sometimes maybe puts a little pressure on you, as added pressure as well. But, you know, unfortunate, because I think we definitely had the car to beat for the Indy 500 this year.
You've won the very last race that was held here in Detroit, because you run race 2 of 2019, if I'm not mistaken. You're currently, in this practice, you were the fastest Honda, fourth fastest overall. How do you feel about this year's duel in Detroit?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. You know, I think it was nice to have the week off after Indy. You know, that had been a long time coming for a lot of people,
sure.
I think. the track was very strange. You know, we were, you know, for the first sort of 30 or 40 minutes, you know, we kept looking at the times and it was 5 to 6 seconds off the, you know, the normal pace. So we couldn't really understand that. There had been, you know, because of the new schedules that we run, we didn't get to run all day until that, you know, 5 o'clock practice. So there was a lot of other rubber down, which I think took a long time for us to kind of convert to the Firestone rubber. So, yeah, interesting session, extremely hot. It's the first time here with the aero screen. There was a lot of drivers hurting yesterday because of that fact. You know, it's very humid, it's very hot, there's no airflow, and it's probably the most brutal street course that we have anyway on the schedule.
Sure,
so,
sure.
You know, today and tomorrow, you're going to see a lot of hurt going on. So it's, you know, there's definitely some cars that are running AC units, which, you know, I wish I'd now ticked that box coming here, which you can't apply right now. So
sure.
That's frustrating. But, yeah, it's going to be a tough race, man.
Yeah.
But this is a race you've always been competitive at. This has been, I think, in my view, kind of a turning point race for you in 2019. And obviously, you're in a very good contention now. Do you feel good about the rest of the season? Because, you know, you're looking for a big seven to add to your tally.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think Detroit is fun. Again, you know, I think strategy-wise is always interesting here. And I think the way that they've added the kind of knockout qualifying format, you can blow all four sets of your reds all in those two qualifying sessions. And that's going to make the races really tough because you've still almost got to do a full stint if you're going to do a two-stopper. So, you know, strategy in Detroit is always pretty tough. You know, will we see some, you know, rain in the afternoon for race one? You know, there's just so many unknowns. But I feel like car speed-wise, I think all of us are going to be very strong under the Ganassi umbrella. And Honda's been doing a superb job all year. So, I don't know, fingers crossed, man. You know, it is definitely a point in the season where these races all fall at once that you need to start making the moves.
Well, you're currently one behind Mario Andretti for IndyCar wins. Maybe by the end of the weekend, you'll be one ahead. Scott Dixon, thank you so much for your time.
That would be awesome, man. Let's do it. Cheers. Cheers.
So, yeah, Scott Dixon, I was hoping in some ways that he'd get at least one win because had he gotten one win, he would have tied Mario Andretti for all-time IndyCar victories. He currently has 51 and Mario Andretti has 52. And he was not able to do that, but despite all these things going on with the red flags and all the other things that happened in the second race, you know, he still went on to score strong points, stay competitive in the points for the championship, and you can see that he's the type of person that's always maximizing whatever situation he's in. So as this 2021 IndyCar season progresses into the second half of the season, definitely still keep a very close eye on Scott Dixon. He will be back. But anyway, great conversation. Thank you so much, Scott. Chris, race two, what say you?
Well, so Pato Award had a tough qualifying session, putting it in the wall, ended up 16th on the grid, and went one better than Ericsson, managing to convert that to a win. So 16th to 1st as opposed to 15th to 1st. So certainly qualifying on the front row didn't seem to guarantee anything, although Newgarden did get pole and finished in the top two. But I thought Award drove an absolutely phenomenal race. I mean, his aggression certainly, in the final laps, you know, the last dozen laps, managed to make, you know, six places, helped a little bit by a couple of caution flags, but pulled off some tremendous moves. I mean, he passed Rahal and Palou, you know, on one lap and then followed it up the next lap by passing Herta to take second place and then, you know, ran Newgarden down and made a good pass on him despite the fact that they touched. Really incredible effort from Award. He wins his second race for McLaren. So now I guess they owe him two tests in a Formula One car, not just one. first driver this season to win two races. So he's on a roll, and now he is our IndyCar championship leader on 299 points.
Yes, by one single point over Alex Palou. But boy, you have to. I'm sure you agree with this. You're skipping over a couple of critical moments here. So that final run of green. There was something like, I believe it was 12 laps to go. Award was seventh with 12 laps to go and went on an absolute storm through the field. He was just possessed, and he just did one amazing move after. He was passing people. He passed two people, including six-time champion, the person we just heard from, Scott Dixon, into turn one, which is like a fourth gear, 110-mile-an-hour corner for IndyCar. That's
Jimmy Johnson,
two of his passes.
Jimmy Johnson couldn't even make that turn on his own, let alone side-by-side with someone
Jimmy
else.
Johnson was the cause of that yellow that you were that allowed this. Had that yellow not occurred, had Jimmy Johnson kept the car pointed in the right direction, Award might have finished fifth, but he wouldn't have been on the podium. That yellow is what closed up more than a 30-second gap between Newgarden and Award. But once that yellow, boy, did he take advantage of it. But Newgarden, he led 67 of the 70 laps of that race. Newgarden was just absolutely charging forward, and he had Colton Herta behind him most of the time. It was well controlled, but then there was a big question mark because Newgarden had to finish his stint, and he had to do a full stint on those option red-marked tires, the ones that we described earlier, which over the course of a racing stint were massively inferior to the standard tire. And many thought Newgarden was a sitting duck, and it turned out to be the case, but not by whom we thought. And so there's 2 points to take from this. Newgarden got a little bit unlucky with the different yellows that fell, but in a lot of ways that was good for him until we saw how just fast Award was. But that also means that over the weekend, the two Penske drivers at some point towards the end of the race were comfortably leading the race, and towards the end of the race, both of them hit massive trouble. Now, Newgarden's was much less severe than Will Power's, but it was ironic, and there's one more bit of irony to this. Roger Penske, not only does he own the IndyCar Series now in the Indianapolis 500, Roger Penske is not technically the owner, but had been a huge, huge role in rejuvenating the Belle Isle race just outside of Detroit, Michigan. Roger Penske single-handedly did more to make the Detroit Grand Prix what it is today than anybody else in the IndyCar family, and he just suffered terrible luck this weekend with two drivers being that close but not being able to take victories. So that was ironic. The one silver lining to it, Chevrolet is the title sponsor of the race. It is the Chevrolet Detroit Grand Prix, powered by Chevy, made by America, something something Chevy, something something America. And Pato O'Ward's car was Chevrolet powered. So Chevrolet did win one of the races this time around. And fast forwarding just a little bit, Cadillac engine did win the IMSA race, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. But it was a crazy race.
I think it is. It was a tough weekend for Penske, no doubt. But I think the second race was a little bit of their own making. I mean, Newgarden was struggling for pace quite a lot earlier on in the race, right? With Herta able to close in on him by over a second a lap at one point. So he was always looking like it was going to be a tough battle to hold on. And then, we saw how much pace Award had. I think he pulled out, 6-7 seconds after he passed Newgarden with only, 4 or 5 laps. But to be fair to Newgarden, I mean, he could have lost 3 or 4 places, but yet somehow he held them off and managed to secure second place, which was an amazing effort, really, considering, he clearly had much, much inferior tyres. Because I think Palou was probably maybe being a bit cautious with the championship in mind, but there was Palou, Herta, Rahal all queuing up to try and make a move, and none of them managed to get it done on Newgarden. So, he at least salvaged a good, strong second place.
Well, and Colton tried to emulate Pato O'Ward with a turn one pass, but thought the better of it. Right at the end, he showed his nose, but tucked right back in.
Yeah,
and that was Colton on Palou. That wasn't on Newgarden.
Right. I mean, turn one was quite a feature of that race. I mean, even right at the beginning on lap one, we had Dixon tangling with Rossi and Grosjean, or Big John, where Dixon basically got
tossed sideways, I think, into Rossi, and then fortunately straightened up, and all three of them survived that particular battle. But yeah, it was really
luckily
good.
Luckily, so, and mm-hmm. you know, that was the I have to say, I think that might have been Dixon's fault. Ultimately, it seemed like he was on the outside of that what turned into a almost three wide entrance into turn one. And turned in pretty sharply, and I don't remember if that was Sato or Rossi. It was someone like that. And it kind of turned into this, like, bumper cars moment that ricocheted right back to Dixon, and he was able to hold on to it, thankfully. But I think it might have been Dixon's initial aggressive turn-in move that had started that whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was Rossi and Big John with Dixon. But yeah, that was so it was fun right from the beginning. I wanted to sort of mention, it looks like we've got a bit of a changing of the guard, don't you think? We've got some new teams, and we've got some new drivers, or newer drivers, really sort of trying to wrench, you know, battle for the title and wrench Dixon's crown away from him. I mean, Dixon's now, what is he?
Fourth. He's now fourth in the championships.
Well, he's 36 points behind O'Ward now.
That's
a reasonable amount.
Well, it is, but it's not. 36 points in IndyCar is not as big as 36 points in Formula One.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want that point to be clear. Everyone scores something in IndyCar points, and I think the winner gets more than 50. So it's a much easier number to recover than were it 36 points in Formula One.
Yeah, that's true. But Dixon, you know, I mean, he finished seventh in the race. And if people like Award and Palou continue to rack up podiums, he's gonna struggle to make up that deficit, isn't he?
Oh, no doubt. Dixon can't keep finishing seventh and win the championship. My point is that this weekend isn't his death knell, is my point.
Yeah, but okay, let's go back through the season so far. Has he really shone on any of the courses we've been to other than Texas?
Well, yeah. Indianapolis 500 was entirely outside of his control. That was just bad luck.
Right.
And
but on the street and road courses, he seems to be struggling relative to some of the other runners. That's my point.
Well, in free practice, which they only got one before qualifying, in free practice, Dixon was fourth quickest. He was the fastest Honda. And then he ended up qualifying 11th. And let me double check here. 11th and 6th at Detroit. So it's not like he was way off in the distance. I'm not remembering where he ended up in the Indianapolis GP, but he was there. He wasn't that far off. And he's been strong at some point in time at every one of these tracks. So I think he's still going to be a formidable championship contender, even though he didn't shine at this weekend. You know, before this weekend, he was the most recent winner of the Detroit Grand Prix, and that was the second race of 2019. So I just think he got caught up with some bad luck.
I'm not disputing that he has a good record in prior seasons on road and street courses. I'm seeing a trend here that he's of course in the mix, but he's certainly not able to be as strong as we're used to seeing on road and street courses this year for whatever reason. I mean, the only race he won was at Texas on the oval. He was strong on both of those races. He was strong in Indy, again an oval. I'm just not seeing the normal Dixon on the other types of tracks that the calendar visits, and they got to find out why that is. Whether it's a setup issue, whether it's whatever it may be. But right now he seems to be consistently being outpaced by some of the young guns on those types of tracks, and that's a problem, as the majority of the tracks IndyCar visits are non-ovals.
Correct. Yeah, I think that he will definitely keep an eye on this, and you know, maybe he isn't able to recover this season, but in general he tends to be stronger in the second half of the season than the first.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he's showing any real red flags here in terms of why he wouldn't continue to be a threat in the going road and street courses. you know, Road America, that's a place where Rossi can be really strong, but Dixon as well. So there's still plenty of opportunities for him to recover. But you're right. It's worth keeping an eye on. I'm certain that Dixon would agree with you that he would have rather finished higher up in these two races. But one person that had come to Detroit for the first time as an IndyCar driver was Jack Harvey. Jack Harvey is the one and only full-time driver for Meyer-Shank Racing, the teammate to the four-time Indy 500 champion Elio Castroneves, who is doing six races this year, did the one, the Indianapolis 500. This was Jack Harvey's first time because his first full season with IndyCar was 2020, and 2020 had a canceled Detroit race. So he was here. He was really excited about the race. He and I spoke Friday afternoon, and here's what he had to say.
I am very pleased to be standing next to full-time Meyer-Shank Racing IndyCar driver, Jack Harvey. Jack, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, mate. How are you?
I'm quite well. I'm enjoying the warm weather, which is hit and miss here in Detroit, which I think you now have experience. Well, do you? Did you run 2019 here?
This is actually the first time I've been here racing. I've come to Detroit since 2017 just to watch, and the weather's always been interesting. So to see it so hot outside, maybe it's like a first time for me here, but I mean, it's going to be a good weekend no matter what.
Well, Detroit is an interesting race, to be sure, for several reasons. First of all, it's near me. That makes it great. Second of all, it is a street course, but it's actually quite quick, considering that it's a street course. Yeah. Then you also have pavement changes, weird camber changes, mid-corner. So there's a lot to take in. So how is your first experience here going?
Honestly, my first experience so far is the track walk. We did that last night, and everything that you just mentioned is really accurate and was very apparent when you walk around. I mean, there is multiple different types of pavements. It's for, you know, decent sections of the track. It's one way. The first thing everyone says about Detroit is how bumpy it is. But actually, when you watch the onboard, you actually do realize what a high-speed track this is, which you know, is maybe a little unusual for street circuits, but honestly at this point I just want to get on track and, you know, feel all them things myself and, you know, try and have the best weekend possible.
Absolutely. Now, this is your first full season in with the team, unless you count 2020, which was a full season of what IndyCar could provide, but this is the full season where you're going to the tracks kind of on a per normal schedule. How is that feeling so far?
It's been really cool, mate. Honestly, I definitely can't last year. You know, when you've been used to missing races, you know, as we did the first 2 years in, you know, 18 and 19, just as we were part time. Last year didn't matter to me that the schedule changed and, you know, it was less races than what we originally thought we were going to do. It was actually still more races than what we had done the year before. So, I mean, there was a positive feeling for us anyway of just an expansion even then. But, you know, this year being able to actually, you know, be on the schedule that was set at the start of the year minus maybe, you know, one or two small tweaks, it's just been awesome. It's good for me, it's good for, you know, everyone at Meyer-Shank Racing, just to get that consistency and that familiarity, you know, with each other. But also you're really in the rhythm of motor racing right now. You know, we're not in any off-season mode. You know, you get a weekend off, you try and enjoy it to its max, but then come Monday you're pretty much ready to get going again, which is basically how my last week has been.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, every race that IndyCar held in 2020, you were there. So this is your second full season with IndyCar. Just pandemic made it feel a little bit less normal. Yeah. So, and you've had some strong races so far. Not quite on the podium, but oh so painfully close. I think it was Barber Motorsports you had a strong run in. And I think the GP of Indianapolis was pretty strong for you. How have you looked at your season so far?
I think we've had plenty of pace. You know, the team's got really amazing potential. I think the thing that we've maybe have missed a little is execution. And this series is so competitive right now that, you know, consistency and execution is probably the number one thing that we need to be targeting. So it's a tough one, mate, because, you know, I look back and think we definitely have missed a few really great results that we know are kind of in our lap to try and get. That being said, we've made really great progress from the off-season, you know, into this year, because you know, we're not talking about necessarily a lack of speed at tracks. We certainly have that. We've just got to work on some of the other small parts of that jigsaw puzzle and, you know, put all the pieces together. But I think as a team we're doing very well. I think the season has gone globally, maybe a little disappointing with some results, but the inner workings of the team I think have been very good. So you know, now it's on us to finish the second half of this season as well as we can, get some good results on the board, and hopefully just keep carrying on.
Absolutely. Now, talking just more big picture, you obviously, your accent is, are you from Massachusetts? No, I'm kidding. You come from England, you race in Europe, you grew up in Formula Fords probably, and then you were did British Formula 3 and GP3 before coming here. What was the biggest driver to have you leave the European side of things and go racing in Indy Lights here in the States?
I mean, honestly, there was no like major factor. You know, I came out to watch the Houston race in 2013 with my dad. You know, Conor Daly was my teammate that year, and he said he was going to do the Indy Lights race, so he came out and watched it, and I really enjoyed it. I met a few people, and throughout that off-season, we got offered the opportunity to race with Sam Schmidt and do Indy Lights. And, you know, chatting with my sponsors at the time, the Racing Steps Foundation, we decided that it was the right thing to do. And, you know, at that moment, Formula One was requiring just a crazy amount of budget to, you know, even be have an association with the teams. And, you know, coming out here, it still felt like we could go and be really competitive on the budget that we had. And obviously, it's, so far, it's working pretty well. But I don't know what it is. I always just felt a pull to America, always enjoyed what I saw on TV and, you know, the people that I met, and just wanted to come and give it a go.
Absolutely. And is there, what would you say has been the biggest adjustment from European racing to racing here in the States? You've had several years experience now. I'm sure you're fully adept. But what was that biggest transition for you?
I mean, I think oval racing is probably the biggest thing. You know, we don't have any of them in Europe, certainly maybe one or two, you know, but certainly not ones that we're racing at consistently. So I think just trying to get used to that. I really just enjoy it here, you know. It's Europe always has a very serious feel to it, which is fine. You know, but I like to be able to walk down the pit lane and not scowl at people, you know, and certainly I don't know if there's any other street circuits like Detroit. You know, in Europe at the minute, just how bumpy they are, and, you know, so many variables on the track. I mean, I think we all love Monaco, but it also looks pretty smooth now compared to what it used to be. So, I don't know, I guess I feel like a lot of the tracks here have maybe a little more character, you know, high commitment, high risk, and just really have enjoyed that. You know, coming back and racing here is probably where I, like, refound my spark and my love for motor racing.
Yeah, I mean, I as a big fan of Formula One, but obviously also a big fan of IndyCar, I've come to the conclusion that because the IndyCars are a little bit more raw, a bit closer to that, like, just super natural raw feeling of racing when you're, like, in go-karts,
sure,
or Formula Ford, that IndyCar captures more of that than certainly Formula One does. But
so,
even F2 and those things and other, you know, series like, you know, the big touring cars and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you for sure. I would say the racing out here is pretty pure. You know, just a lot of genuine race fans still focusing on, you know, maybe not having, you know, the biggest or nicest hospitality unit, but making sure that the team has all the bits that it needs to be successful, so that when the car goes on track, it can be quick. And I totally agree with your assessment on that.
Yeah. Now, you have a teammate now for a few races, and that teammate made his debut at the Indianapolis 500, and I'm trying to remember where he finished. It was somewhere in the top 33, but of course, obviously, having Elio Castroneves as a teammate, who obviously also put his stamp on being an IndyCar again, what's that experience been like?
Oh, I mean, Elio's a really nice guy. You know, he's an absolute gentleman. He's wicked quick in a race car. Since he joined the team, you know, his input and his you know, support of me, of the team, has been massive. And even on the weekends that he wasn't racing, certainly we felt like he was contributing something, you know, really nice to the team. And I mean, he's one of the greatest ever to go around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, so, you know, to be able to watch him do his thing, try and learn from him as much as I can, was hopefully is going to pay dividend in the future as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm keen in on this Europe and American contrast here a little bit more, a couple more questions. American cuisine versus European cuisine. Give me a plus and a minus.
I think cheeseburgers are better here. Well, the thing is, right, I mean, I don't think the UK is known for its, like, cuisine. You know, like, I miss some curry. I actually miss Chinese food from the UK. My mum makes a killer roast dinner. It depends what part of Europe you're talking about, but I'm not sure the UK is known for its stud cuisine.
So you're not dying for a shepherd's pie or something like that, per se.
I miss, like, proper bacon. I miss, like, English bacon.
Do you describe, what is English bacon? Is it thicker cut?
It's slightly thicker cut. It's not burnt, and I like that.
Okay, all right. And finally, the most important question of all, I ask this to every Englishman I meet. Do you like iced tea?
Iced tea? I'm not even sure if I've had that yet.
Oh, dude, you got to try it. It's the best thing ever. It's like hot tea, but it's cold and refreshing.
Sounds interestingly wrong.
Well, Jack Harvey, really appreciate your time. Great to be able to chat with you, and really good luck this weekend at the Duel in Detroit. You have two races to prove your point. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay, Chris, there you go. Yet another Brit that doesn't like iced tea. This is not great. I have time with Jack. I will show him the light.
Yeah. So was he able to understand you okay? You guys talk about soccer or football, or was there any confusion there? Field hockey, ice hockey, that type of thing?
I think I threw in enough bippity-boppities before we started recording that we developed a relationship. I did refrain from ever calling him governor. No, but we had a lovely chat. He's 28 years old, and what I really appreciated about Jack was his just pure raw enthusiasm for the sport. And just, you know, he's like, hey, I'm very excited to be here. I love to race. He spoke very positively about IndyCar in general. And, you know, he was just one of those guys that's like, I'm making a living driving race cars. Why should I be upset about that? And that was the attitude I got from him, and I really respect that. And, you know, he races for Michael Schenck, whom I've interviewed a couple of times on this show already. And, you know, I can see why Michael Schenck likes Jack. He's got the right attitude for that team. And, you know, Jack's been competitive earlier this season. I can't remember. I think it was the Indianapolis Grand Prix, where he ended up just outside the podium with a fourth-place finish. He was looking strong there for a while.
I think he had a strong weekend in St. Petersburg, didn't he, as well?
Yeah, that sounds correct, yeah. And maybe it was St. Pete that was his strongest weekend. But this is his first time here. It'd be really hard to be competitive here your first time round. And, you know, and he had a bit of bad luck as well. But, you know, considering all those things, you know, he ended up finishing 16th in the first race, 19th in the second race. Not a strong showing, not ideal. I'm sure he'll be more comfortable and up to speed quicker at Road America.
Yeah, so should we talk about Jimmy? Did you get to interview him? Did you,
you
ask
know,
him?
It's funny.
Why so slow?
Well, here's what happened. No, I did not get a chance to talk to Jimmy, but my scheduled time to interview Scott Dixon was Saturday morning before qualifying, and it came immediately after there was this big scrum around Jimmy Johnson. So I had to grab Chip Ganassi's PR guy and say, hey, man. He's like, oh, yeah. And it was almost like, oh, thank God, someone not here for Jimmy Johnson. But the other thing about Jimmy Johnson, racing legend Scott Pruitt, who is also a Ganassi veteran, Ganassi on the sports car side, Scott Pruitt was there as kind of like a Jimmy Johnson coach slash consultant to help him kind of get through it. And I actually bumped into Scott Pruitt and talked with him for a couple minutes in the paddock over the weekend. And Scott was like, look, man, of all the places to come in your rookie year, and he didn't mean rookie year in IndyCar only. He meant, you know, rookie year in formula cars, rookie year in this kind of racing at all. And to come here, he's like, this place is brutal. This is a steep, steep learning curve, you know. So Scott was very sympathetic to Jimmy, Johnson, as you would expect him to be, as, you know, someone there to help him. But he's right in the sense that Detroit is not the place to have a whole lot of new things come at you at once. And he did. And he was improving, but improving from pretty dismal performance to still not great performance.
Well, has it been confirmed that he actually pulled off a pass during the race, in the second race? Because I saw it looked like he was alongside someone and then we cut away. And I'm not sure he ever completed the pass. But that's progress if he's quick enough to pass somebody.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, maybe he tried to bump draft and it didn't work. You know, he's just... We joke about him a decent amount, and I plan on continuing to joke about him. But you do have to give him respect for making this big of a leap, this much in the spotlight.
Yeah, yeah,
I will. You have to concede that, and I certainly will. That, you know, my performance in NASCAR would be equally dismal. And I'm of course not talking about Cup. I'm, you know, whatever regional little circle track something that I would do, I'm sure my performance would be nowhere near as it is on a road course. So
yeah,
the fact that he's jumping into IndyCar and doing what he's doing, maybe it's just foolish, but you have to at least at some level respect it.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Of course, what he's trying to do is extremely challenging. But I think, you know, there's been a lot of drivers switch series over the years, and I don't think any of them have ever struggled quite to this extent. So it's, and having had so much success in NASCAR, I think it just comes as a bit of a shock to everyone. And it was really interesting to hear some of Jeff Gordon's views on his struggles. And he had a lot of sympathy for him. And he was describing how the brake application between a NASCAR and an IndyCar is extremely different.
That was super interesting.
Yeah,
what Jeff Gordon was saying about brakes. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was basically saying that you can only put about 60% brake application in a NASCAR to settle a car down before you then apply full brake pressure. And in an IndyCar, obviously you're hard on it immediately, basically flat to the floor, essentially, is what he was describing. And so to learn how to brake an IndyCar when you've had, you know, so many years of experience in a vehicle that requires a very different brake application is obviously going to take a long time to get your brain to train to that way of thinking, and it will be very unnatural to him. But the other part that really caught my ear in that interview was how Jeff was basically saying, well, you know what, we all understand that this is a tough task, and we all have sympathy and we understand it's a very different type of vehicle, but ultimately it's going to reflect on the NASCAR community if he doesn't pull it together. And I thought that was really quite...
Yeah, it already has. I mean, it already has.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed mindsets, I think more cemented them, but yeah. I mean, yeah. We've had people go the other way. Tony Stewart is a good example. Tony Stewart, it was IRL. It was all ovals for Tony Stewart, but he was in IndyCar before he was in NASCAR Cup.
Montoya, and Danica Patrick. I mean, there's been a lot of them, right? And they've all done reasonably well. They haven't been at the back and competitive spinning every three minutes, right? I mean, that's the difference.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and Montoya won a couple races. I'm pretty sure they were both the rare road courses that Cup attends. I'm trying to remember if Danica won a Cup race or not. I know she was up there a few times. I don't remember if she ever won a Cup race. I also don't care that much.
Yeah, I mean, it's early on, isn't it? And if he's got a coach and he's working on it, then, I mean, how much in-season testing are they able to do? I mean, if I was in his situation, I'd just be pounding around every track for a few days before I visited. I mean, you know, I don't think there's restrictions, are there, really? In-season IndyCar testing?
Nothing like Formula One, but yes, there are restrictions. So, I don't know. I don't know enough to say specifically, but let's summarize it this way. Jimmy Johnson continued to maintain his reputation in IndyCar. And to his credit, Detroit is one heck of a place to try to change that reputation. And he didn't do it. Scott Pruitt and most likely Jimmy Johnson is feeling much more optimistic about when Jimmy Johnson follows IndyCar to Road America next week or 2 weeks from now, whenever it is. And
well, that's not an easy track, Road America.
No, it's not an easy track. But it's much easier to learn without the consequences being quite so severe. Mm-hmm. And it is a little bit more consistent. So what you do in the afternoon is more likely to stay roughly the same when you go to it the next morning. Whereas in Detroit, it could be night and day different.
But you're right. I mean, some of the drivers made driving around the Belle Isle look tricky, and yet somehow they came out looking better for it, because there were some wonderful power slides. There were some great tank slappers. I think Palou had one huge moment, but yet he managed to gather it all up and keep it between the walls. So there was some really impressive driving going on, and you could really see the cars moving around under braking, out of corners, and it looked a lot of fun, actually. But I agree, it did look challenging.
Yeah. So we had two fantastic IndyCar races, and yet that was only two-thirds of the racing that was going on, because there was also a 100-minute-long IMSA WeatherTech Series race, which is the top class, the top series in IMSA, which includes the DPI cars, GT Le Mans, GTD, which is effectively GT3. And technically, all three classes were represented in Detroit. Usually, it's just the DPI cars and the GTD cars. But because Le Mans has moved to August, Chevrolet brought out its two GTLM cars. So there was a non-points finishing race between the number three Chevrolet with Antonio Garcia and Jordan Taylor, and the number four Chevrolet with Tommy Milner and Nick Tandy. And wouldn't you know it, Chevrolet won that class in IMSA, which was lovely for them. But it was a really good hard race. With 100 minutes in an endurance car, it is, you know, more and more endurance racing is becoming just long sprint races, but this especially, it is one pit stop all but guaranteed, and it is just how quickly and efficiently can you get your pit stops in, and then are you a little lucky with, you know, the way the race plays out in terms of strategy, those types of things. But Kevin Magnussen and Ranger van der Zande won in the Cadillac DPI car. They beat out another Cadillac driven by another Formula One veteran, Felipe Nasr, and Pippo Durrani. And third place went to Ricky Taylor and Philippe Albuquerque. And that was the top finishing Acura. I didn't interview any of those people. But I did interview the Acura drivers that ended up finishing last in class, and that was Dane Cameron and Olivier Pla. They contest in the Meyer Shank Racing IMSA DPI car. So again, Meyer Shank Racing put on the IMSA side, and I spoke to those two together, and this is what they had to say.
Well, I'm very excited to be at the very edge of the camera, speaking with Michael Shank drivers Dane Cameron and Olivier Pla, and I'll know in a moment if I said it correctly or not. But this is the Detroit IMSA race that they're getting ready for tomorrow on Saturday. And Dane, I want to start with you. You are in kind of an odd position where you're switching teams, but you're actually not switching cars. So what's it like actually getting in the same car as last year, but with a different team now with Meyer Shank Racing?
Yeah, definitely different. Normally when you change teams or even stay the same team, you get new cars pretty often these days. So a little bit different to sort of follow the car to its new home. But it's been really good. It's been really helpful to bring my experience of 3 years in this car before. So fourth year in the same car is the most time I've ever spent in a single race car. So I know the thing pretty well at this point. So I think it's hopefully been helpful to, get things going here and keep us on the right track. And, I kind of know what I'm looking for in terms of the feel. So just try to speed things along a little bit. And, it's been really good group of people here.
Now, Olivier, this is a little bit more of a traditional new team for you. So my first question for you is, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yeah, no, it was perfect.
Close enough.
Yeah, close.
Close enough.
Very good. So, new team, new car. You've been in the sports car world for a while now. What are your feelings getting into this Acura?
Actually, not really a new team because I had a chance to drive for Mike back in 2016 when we won Petit Le Mans together. But yeah, for sure, different car. It's very different to what I get used to had the last 2 years, especially. But getting there, you know, I obviously rely a lot on the day and experience, you know, with this car. So it's really helpful for me.
So the Detroit street circuit is very unique because it's a tight street course, a lot of concrete, but it's also a pretty darn fast street course. And you've got pavement changes, and you can have wind be a factor. You have different on-camber, off-camber turns. So how do you navigate what can be a complicated circuit? Dane, I'll start with you.
Ollie and I were both talking before we came here. For us, it's one of our favorite street courses for sure that we've been to, and we both enjoy street courses quite a lot. So it's definitely a different challenge when you come here with all the walls, and it's fun to feel like there's no margin for error. You have to be very, very focused and very precise with the car. It's a really fun challenge. And, yeah, as you say, for sure, Detroit is one of the quicker street courses that you see. You know, typically they're pretty slow with, you know, just tight corners and big brake zones. But, you know, turns 1 and 2 and then 11 and 12 here, the last couple corners are actually pretty fast, especially in a downforce car like these Acura prototypes. So it's a really big challenge, and when you've been here enough times, you sort of know this corner is never really going to change. It's sort of always a problem because there's this pavement. You know, every year you come, and it's the most important one to walk because you never know what's been repaved or what's been changed. So you usually spend most of your time arguing with everybody about what was actually new or different. No, that was there. No, it wasn't. No, I'm pretty sure it was there. All that kind of stuff. So it's definitely a challenge, and the car is never perfect. So a little bit like Sebring, obviously, but lined with walls. But I really enjoy that challenge of getting the thing as close as you can to driving well, and the last little bit you kind of just have to, you know, lace your shoes up and just get it done.
Yeah, for sure, it's a very challenging place. I've always been a big fan of a street track like that, but you're never gonna get the perfect balance. It's always a question of compromise. It's a special place to run. You know, as like Dane said, the last two corners or turn one, turn two are pretty fast in between the walls. So it's a nice feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. Absolutely. There it comes. And now, in this car, are 11 and 12 flat, or are they lifts, or do you have to get on the brake a little bit?
12 is a braking. That's a little bit tighter. 11 is just a lift, so we'll see. We'll see who can be the bravest in qualifying. Maybe it'd be pretty close, probably in qualifying trim. You know, depending on how the track changes. Again, another big factor of street course is the track evolves way more than a normal road course, you know, in terms of rubber, because it's a street, normal street. So a lot of dust and dirt here. We were quite early in the morning today, so it's always kind of a bit of a throwaway. The first half of that session is basically just sweeping.
We like to call it true Detroit grit, actually.
It was a little sandy out there.
And this is an endurance race, but it's actually oftentimes shorter than the IndyCar races, being only 100 minutes. So it's very much, more and more all of the endurance races are, but this is very much a sprint race. So how critical is your pit change, and how do you have a different mindset for such a short endurance race?
Well, qualifying here is critical. You know, you want to qualify at the front. Track position, I think, is everything from the beginning of the race, you know. So that's the first thing. And then after traffic, it's always really challenging, you know, in a place like that. So, but you need everything. You need a good out lap, you know, good in laps. Everything needs to be perfect.
Yeah, I think as you say, the endurance races have gone pretty much to flat out races, but you know, there's always a little bit of ease in the back of your mind, at least for the beginning of those races, that if something goes wrong, you know, it's okay. There's going to be probably a yellow. There's going to be another stop. You know, it'll be fine. You can kind of fix it. When you come here, in Long Beach as well, our two shortest races. The intensity is really, really high. Like Ollie said, the need to have every detail perfect is the highest it is over the course of the year. Really no margin for error. Like, you need to qualify up front, stay up front. The pit stops need to be perfect, driver changes, all that sort of stuff. Pretty high pressure in terms of that for this weekend. So it's probably the most intense race of the year for sure to be in this one in such a pressure cooker. You know, when you're used to close to 3 hour races and you come here for 100 minutes, it definitely changes everything.
And I'm also curious about, you guys mentioned rubbering in, but does the rubber from the Indy cars and the Indy lights and the other series, does that mesh well with the rubber you guys have in IMSA, or is there a bit of a factor of scrubbing off the IndyCar rubber before you guys can really lay down the laps you want?
Well, I think Dane has a bit more info than me on this one, because the last time I've been there was 2014, so a long time ago.
You forgot by now?
Yeah, I forgot by now.
I think at a street course, you're sort of just so desperate for anything, for, you know, there's so much cleaning that happens compared to a normal track in terms of the surface improving, that you're kind of will take anything. There for sure is a certain point where it just sort of plateaus and it doesn't really get any better. That rubber starts to get hot, the temperature of the track and the weather gets a little bit too hot, and it'll peak pretty quick. But these first couple of sessions is a pretty big evolution in terms of how it changes. So normally the IndyCar rubber is pretty good for us, and like I say, you're so desperate for any bit of rubber on the track to kind of cling to, it doesn't really matter where it comes from.
Well, Dane Cameron, Olivier Pla, welcome to Detroit, welcome to Détroit, and really happy to join, that you guys could join me here in the back. We're behind the MSR trucks, the Meyer-Shank Racing trucks, getting ready to contest the IMSA Detroit race in their Acura DPI car.
So, as you can see, between the two Frenchmen I spoke with, Romain Grosjean, I'm practicing, see, now that I've spoken with him, is the much more lighthearted of the two French drivers I spoke with. Nothing against Olivier, just Romain was much more affable. Maybe it's that he's actually Swiss, half Swiss, with two passports. But thank you to Dane Cameron and Olivier Pla for the conversation. It was really insightful, and I appreciated hearing from them. Unfortunately, it didn't convert to results, so that is what it is, I suppose. But it was a good race for them, and the GTLM class, the non-points finishing race, it was great for the Corvettes. But then when we got to, there were 12 GTD cars competing. And when I say GTD cars, I'm talking about Aston Martin, Lamborghini, Acura NSX, Lexus RCF, and Mercedes AMG, BMW M6. I mean, just a lot of great, great names. Oh, and of course, a Porsche 911. And so the GTD class is always interesting to watch and to see. And I actually got a chance to speak with two different GTD class IMSA drivers. First, Brian Sellers, someone that I've met a few times in the past and actually wrote a big feature article on back in my Auto Week days. So he and I have gotten to know each other a little bit. He ended up finishing sixth in class in his Paul Miller Racing Lamborghini Huracan GT3. Here's what he had to say.
Here I am chatting with Paul Miller Racing Lamborghini driver, and I'm going to say friend. He doesn't know I'm saying that, so we'll see how he reacts. Brian Sellers. Brian, how are you?
Good. I would go with acquaintance more than friend, but friend's fine for where we're at. I'm good, man. We're at Detroit hanging out. It's a little hot, but looks like maybe we have some rain coming. Going to be an interesting day. Who knows?
So, friend in training. I'm very excited that you're back in racing. You know, you had a real strong 2019 and then a fantastic 2020 with the 24 Hours of Daytona. And then the pandemic hit, and that kind of threw everything in a whirlwind. And Paul Miller, even when the racing started, Paul Miller Racing didn't start right away. So you've had some real time off in 2020.
Yeah, it was difficult. you know, the pandemic certainly affects a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And to be honest, to say that, like, it was all negative for me wouldn't have been true. I got to spend a lot of time with my family. I have two kids at home, and my wife that we don't get to see that often. So, you know, there were parts of it that were great. The obvious downside is we didn't come back racing. And we didn't come back racing because Paul had to furlough so many people on his dealership that there was no way he was going to make that commitment to go racing and have those people sit at home, which is, I think, super admirable, right? When things started to open back up and pick back up, he held true to the racing side also, and we went back and we did the endurance races. And it's great because I think those are your pinnacle races through the sport, but it's not enough. You know, four races a year isn't quite enough. So we're all super happy to be back for a full season again. You know, it's funny, like, you go away for six races and all of a sudden people start asking you guys, like, oh, are you guys back? You doing the full season? You're like, well, we didn't really leave by choice, you know? So, but yeah, we're back. We're doing the full season and it's tough. I mean, when you go away for a while, there's stuff that has to come back and you know, you got to get back in your swing of things. And we're still kind of very much in that mode, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's inevitable. Even the toppest guys with the biggest factory teams, there's kinks to work out. There always is. Some rust to shake off, those types of things. And specifically for Detroit, you haven't been here since 2019, but at the same time, no one has. So maybe in a way, that's a little bit of a leveling effect.
It is, definitely. I mean, the one thing for sure is track time is always a premium, right? And I think for us, the difficulty in this weekend is we had a motor issue in at the end of the first session, and we had to sit out the second session. And I think that goes to show you exactly how difficult track time is to come by and how important it is. You miss an hour and a half, and you completely kind of fall out. You know, in the first session, we were in the top three, top four. You miss a session, and we struggle to sit in the top six, top eight.
Yeah.
And, you know, that you just, with these level of teams and drivers, and it's not just the car setup that you lose, it's the familiarity with the track over another hour and a half. It's tough. So we're kind of trying to dig our way out of a hole right now.
Well, and Detroit is such a weird beast in that way because it's a very complicated track. A lot of off camber, a lot of surface changes, and it's deceptively quick considering it's a street course. But on top of that, it's also very dynamic. There's always a new patch of pavement here. Somewhere that was bumpy is smooth, and somewhere that was smooth is bumpy. So it's very much got a life of its own. So there is always a lot new to learn. Do you feel like you're on top of that part of it?
Yeah, I think we're on top of that part. That, you know, the real thing about Detroit, I think, that separates itself from a lot of other places is it's a circuit where you have to be kind of 11 tenths, not even 10 tenths, to do a lap time.
Yeah.
And there's a couple other places where you can manipulate that a little bit and not be, you know, 100% on the brakes, but roll more mid-corner speed and gain lap time. But this place is if you're not up against every single wall and you're not as late as you can be everywhere on the brakes and you know, just X, Y, Z and knocking them all off, then you lose lap time, a lot of lap time. And that's hard to get on a street course when you're in between the walls all the time, you know. So it takes some laps to get that going. And I think that some of that is probably where Madison and I will miss just a touch right now. But it'll come quick in the race when you're around other cars.
And this is kind of a bizarre race on top of everything else because you only got 100 minutes. So you've got to get up to speed really quick. And then you also have a really critical in-lap, out-lap, because you have one and only pit stop, if you have any chance. And so how much preparation goes into that part of it?
I mean, almost everything. The whole race revolves around exactly what you just said. Your in-lap, your out-lap, and your pit stop. Everything else is somewhat irrelevant. I mean, if you have good in-laps, good out-laps, and a good stop, and you can put yourself in good track position, then you just fight the best you can and see where you end up. But if you alternately have bad in outlaps or a bad stop, your race is likely over. It's so difficult to pass, and track position means everything. So it's everybody's focus. You know, in the beginning, the teams that hadn't really been here missed out on that. So, you know, the ones that had done the race before kind of always had an advantage, and they knew, how to get around that, but now everybody knows. I mean, it's clear. These are a bunch of smart people. So you can't keep secrets like that for long.
Everyone
will put their focus on that.
So do you think this is one of the strongest races for you, or are you more encouraged later in the season? Like, I know you're always good at Petite, at Road Atlanta. Are there other places that you feel like is a more inherently Lamborghini-strong place?
I mean, I think we're kind of... This is going to come out wrong, but I think we're kind of just run-of-the-mill, you know? Like, we're... We're not terrible anywhere.
Best mill on the planet, right? Exactly.
I mean, we're not. I would say we're not really terrible anywhere, and I don't think that we have one place that I just think, oh my God, we're amazing. You know,
it's not like this car is suited to one.
Not particularly.
Place.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's pretty well rounded. So, you know, we'll struggle in a couple of the races coming forward, but we'll be good in a couple of them too. You know, so. It's also difficult for me to answer that because so much has changed since the last time we did a full season. So, you know, the last time we did a full season was 2019, and in 2019 we were still using two different compound tires. We were using a soft tire and a hard tire.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of the places that we were stronger were on the soft tire, and places we were not as good were on the hard tire. So I don't know what those places are going to be like when we go back to. So it's hard to answer.
So I just let you kind of like end this with a statement. As you know, this is one of the few race cars I've actually driven. I drove a GT3 car in Italy. So if Madison has too much trouble, you let me know. I think we're about the same height, and I'll jump in.
And about the same weight now, too.
And I'm a local, so I know all the nuances. So here is my best friend that he's ever known, Brian Sellers. Brian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
That's right. I am Brian Sellers' best friend for life. We are BFFs. Nothing you can do about it. That is just the fact of the matter, and that will never change. And Brian, I consider you very lucky for that. Now, finishing actually two places ahead of Brian was Jack Hawksworth. Now, this one is an interesting one because Jack races in – he's another Brit – and he races in this Lexus RCF GT3 car, which is big. I mean, this is a big two-door luxury coupe on the road. But in race trim, you know, it's proven to be quite competitive. Obviously, GTD, just like all of endurance racing, they have a big balance of performance equation that keeps the cars on par with each other. But they ended up finishing fourth in class in the 100-minute endurance race that took place Saturday evening, and here's what Jack had to say about his racing.
I'm very happy to have the privilege to speak with Vassar Sullivan Lexus RCF GTD driver Jack Hawksworth. Jack, how are you?
Very well, thank you. Nice to be in Detroit.
Well, it is nice to be in Detroit, isn't it? But it's kind of unpredictable to be in Detroit in terms of the weather. It can be 50 degrees and rainy in early June, and it can be well into the 80s and quite sunny. How are you coping with the temperature change?
Shall I hold it, yeah?
No, just I'll hold it for you.
Today's been really hot, so, you know, this is on the warm side for us. But you're right, I've been to Detroit before when it's been 50 and raining at this race, and then sometimes it's, you know, boiling hot, and hour to hour it can change. So even the forecast for tomorrow, it looks like there's a 50% chance of a big rainstorm at one point or another. So you just take the weather as it comes. But, yeah, you never know here. It always keeps you on your toes, the weather.
Yeah, now... You're from England. You have dealt with inclement weather in a race car before, I'm sure. So that in of itself is not going to be a challenge. But Detroit is actually a deceptively high-speed street course. And you've also got pavement changes. And you've got interesting camber changes. So there's a lot of different things to think about as you go through a lap here. What's your mental approach to a lap around here?
Yeah, this place is really tricky. There's, like you say, a lot of character to it. It's got quite a lot of faster corners on it, which you don't typically see on a street course. Street course corners tend to be 90 degree, usually, slower speed stuff. But turns 1, 2, 13 at this track, really high speed, high commitment stuff. A lot of camber, a lot of crown in the road. no room for error. So certainly for all the drivers, it's really tricky. Throw in some inclement weather, you know, and you've got, you know, drains and all kinds of stuff around the circuit. So it really is a real challenge. But as a driver, this is, you know, this is what we love to do. We like a challenge. We like coming to circuits which test us, and nowhere tests you as hard as Detroit does. So I always enjoy coming in.
The other part that's a little bit different, not necessarily than every other race, but this is an endurance racing series, and yet the race itself in all likelihood is going to be shorter than the IndyCar race, only 100 minutes long. So it's very much a sprint race, despite the fact that it's an endurance racing series. So how does that adjust your approach to what you're doing? It's just one pit stop, and in and out laps are super important. How do you take that approach?
It just really puts a lot more importance on qualifying and the pit stop, and then, like you say, in laps and out laps and whatnot. So just changes the importance, really, of how important a couple of things, key things are, key elements to the weekend. It's the great thing about IMSA is we have so many races of different lengths. You know, we do have the long 24 hours and 12 hour races, which require a completely different mindset. You know, and then we come to Detroit and we come to Long Beach, where we've got 100 minutes, one pit stop, and you've got to get your start right. You've got to have a good stop, and yeah, there's not a lot of time to recover.
Now let's take a slightly bigger picture. You grew up racing in England. You started in single seaters. You came here for Star Mazda, Indy Lights, and I think you had some IndyCar starts as well. What has in the transition been like to go from a formula car to a sports car?
Yeah, I've raced a lot of different cars, I guess, throughout my career, but started off racing go-karts and then raced various open-wheel cars for quite a long time. I think you can, like, driving's driving at the end of the day, whether it's a GT car, whether it's a stock car or an Indy car. But the biggest thing, I guess, coming from, you know, IndyCar world, is that when you go from IndyCar to IMSA GT3 cars, they're a little bit heavier, they've got a little bit less tyre, a little bit less downforce. So you tend to have to drive the car a little bit smoother. You can't be as aggressive with the vehicle. With an Indy car, your big fat tyres, you can really, really throw the thing about and it'll still stick. Because with a GT car, if you really try to overdrive the car, it's quite easy to have a slide and lose lap time. So just really just driving to the limit of the vehicle you're in, you know, just getting used to your new, you know, the limit of how fast you can go. If it's there in an Indy car, it's there in a GT3 car, right? So it's just bringing that, dialing it back a little bit.
So you've been here several years now, but how do you compare European racing to racing here in the United States?
What I love about racing in the United States, especially in IMSA, and IndyCar's the same as well, like the racing's a lot more raw. The tracks that we go to, there's no track limits, because the track limits are self-policing. You know, if you're on a road course, there's grass and gravel all around you. If you're on a street course, there's walls all around you. Whilst in Europe, they have a big problem at the minute because of all of the tarmac runoffs. And for a driver, I like the fact that, you know, you can't drop a wheel and you can't make mistakes, because that's, for me, that makes this, it puts more emphasis on the driver. And requires more skill of the driver. So I think that part of it I like. I like the fact that we still have safety cars over here, and not virtual safety cars, and just more raw, kind of simplified version of racing, which I think is more appealing for the fans, and then a lot more appealing for the drivers as well, because you have more input and they ask more of you, basically.
And the one thing that you look at racing here and GT cars and everything else, what about the variety of GT cars here? I mean, you're racing what is fundamentally a big car with a V8, and then you've got some proper sports cars. I mean, there's just a huge variety, even within the GTD category.
Yeah, the GT3 feels a who's who of motorsport manufacturers, right? You've got, you know, Lexus, Ferrari, Audi, Lamborghini, BMW, Acura. The list just goes on and on. And like you say, it's great for the fans to have so many different manufacturers with so many different car philosophies, you know, front engine, mid-engine, rear engine, just it's really interesting racing because certain cars will work well on certain parts of a track and vice versa. So I think it's really interesting.
And finally, one question that I ask every British driver, every British person I know. Have you tried iced tea?
I've had iced tea, yeah. I wouldn't say it's like something that I love, though.
Okay, all right. So still room for improvement for Jack Hawksworth, but thank you so much for your time. Good luck this weekend.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Cheers.
And I'm still not done with Lexus, Chris, because not only did they give me the opportunity to speak with Jack Hawksworth, they actually gave me access to their team manager, Greg Cates, and I had my camera on and we did a walk around of the GT3 race car. So my YouTube video, of which I did several, I did a bunch of interviews that are all up on YouTube, but this, I did a walk around of Jack Hawksworth. Boy, that's a tongue twister for me. I went around his race car and got to learn some interesting details about it. So my go to my YouTube channel, YouTube plug of the podcast, is going to be on this Lexus RCF GT3 car that I got to look at nice and closely. And I encourage you to watch it because there were some cool, interesting details that I learned from. And Chris, I shared it with you ahead of time. I'm sure you watched it at least three or four times. What were your favorite parts about that car?
Well, it's the most exciting Lexus I've ever seen. I'd certainly like to do a few laps in that. Yeah, it looked pretty sweet. I thought he was particularly coy on the tricks they used to extract more power out of the V8. He didn't want to give anything away there, did he?
Well, that was a little bit bizarre to me because there's not that much that goes on. I mean, the engine, that engine in production form doesn't make much less horsepower than it does in race trim. So, and it's naturally aspirated in both occasions. I'm sure there's some different tricks with heat and with endurance and with strength of the parts so that they can, you know, maybe eke out a little bit more torque at lower RPM, you know, have a broader power band to work with, and some strengthening of different various seals and things like that. But it's not some big secret. It's not like they're finding some ways to win every race despite BOP or anything like that. So I felt that was a little bit unnecessary, that coyness. But hey, whatever. Still got to take a close look at the car, and it was still cool.
Yeah, and I was also impressed how the mechanics didn't miss a beat despite you interviewing him around the car. They were cracking on with the schedule, weren't they? They literally drove it out as you were finishing the interview. I was pretty impressed by that.
Well, just ahead of when we started recording that, Greg Cates has said, all right, we need to get these things done before qualifying. So they were cracking on because they had to get the car ready. So it rolled off because it had to get to some pre-tech before qualifying, which was going on in whatever 45 minutes after we were done talking. So, yeah. It was an interesting moment, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, it was a crazy weekend with very, very, very little Formula One involved, and yet plenty of excitement. And it was just so much satisfaction for me to be able to just do so much work at a Grand Prix, at a racing event, but be able to focus solely on this podcast and my YouTube channel. So that was really special for me. So I do want to take a quick moment and say just thank you, everyone that listens, because it's because you guys listen that I can do these things, and I'm just deeply appreciative for that.
Yeah, so mentioning Formula One, so we're off to Paul Ricard this weekend, which is not one of my favorite tracks, honestly. It's like
your second favorite then?
I'd say it's not even my second favorite track in France. I can think of at least two or three that I would. Obviously, Le Mans would be number one. But
yeah, but I mean, Magna Cura isn't great either.
No, it is a tricky one. That, but I'd probably still put Magna Cura ahead of Paul Ricard. I mean, because Bernie turned it into a test track, didn't he? And so it has different track layouts. It has just oceans and oceans of runoff that are all painted in lurid colours. And, you know, the cars get lost in all that sea of blue that they've painted everywhere. And
well, there's some red and white as well.
Yeah, there you go. French colours. So, Yeah, no, not a favourite of mine. I mean, we have had some interesting races in the past, so that shouldn't turn potential viewers off. I remember one, was a couple of years ago, where we had a great sort of last couple of lap battle where people were taking all sorts of different lines to try and get ahead. I think Lando was struggling with hydraulic issues that triggered all sorts of interesting manoeuvres. The only significant news, I guess, for those of us who are Williams fans, is that Simon Roberts has been booted out of the team by Joost Capito. And so the reshuffle continues at Williams. And we've got this fabulously named technical director called FX de Maison, but I'm sure you can butcher that name better than me.
I'll just call him Mr. Krebs. I hear so he's delicious.
So between FX and Joost, they've had a lot of success in the VW racing empire over the years, including in rallying. So we'll have to see if they can bring some magic to Williams moving forward. But, you know, Simon Roberts wasn't very well known, but he, you know, he had spent a long time at McLaren and had a pretty good F1 history. So you could, you know, the rotating door of personnel that try and resurrect the good ship Williams continues. And let's hope there's some progress made sooner rather than later.
Yes. Well, and there's another reason for you, Chris, to potentially enjoy the French Grand Prix and indeed Paul Ricard. I think that Lewis Hamilton has a much better chance of winning this weekend, this coming weekend, than he did this past weekend. So,
is that because they've changed they've changed the steering wheel buttons for this weekend, is it?
Yes. But for now, I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you get our podcast. And I really want to take a moment to say, please, please, please do that. We haven't gotten any reviews in a while, and something new and fresh, especially if it's positive, would be super wonderful. And also, please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, always lovely to chat. Thank you again.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.